from my heart, from my mind, from my strength, I will worship you.
It's one thing for me to be asking God to help me lose weight. But if I don't stop eating those delicious chocolate candies we got at Easter, that's not going to happen. I can pray all that I want. But if I don't change my behavior, I'm sorry, it isn't going to happen. You with me? Understand this? I can see one of those TV ads for Bowflex, and I look at the guy on there and I think,
you know, suck it in, or, you know, like, wow, I want one of those.
You know, I want to be like that. Well, I got a call, I have to order, I have to spend a whole lot of money. And then when the thing comes, I probably have to put it together. I don't know, I've never gotten one. And then you actually have to use it. You actually have to do something. That kind of sounds obvious, right? I think we get that, right? So why is it such a hard concept for us to think that spiritual growth is any different? Spiritual growth requires spiritual discipline. Paul uses the picture in 1 Corinthians 9. He says, do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now, they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we an imperishable crown. Now, in Paul's day, in the Olympics, they didn't get pretty gold medals. They got wreaths of olive branches, and they perished. They dried up. He says, therefore, I run thus, not with uncertainty. Thus, I fight not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. Paul talks about living the Christian life as if he's preparing for an Olympic race, an Olympic event. There are areas of my life that require discipline. I have to follow through on things. I don't just ask, I have to do some things. For example, victory over sin. You know, I have some friends who know a lot about AA and this concept, working the program. This is what I get from, this is what I've learned watching them. You've got to work the program. You know, if you want to find freedom from your addiction, you have to take some steps. You don't just take one step and then it's over. You have to follow through. You have to take some steps. And we've watched folks who take one step or two steps, right? And we've watched them stop stepping and then everything falls apart, right? We've all seen it. We've probably all seen it in our lives in different ways. Victory over sin is so, it's what it's, that's, there are lots of steps we need to take. We need to keep at the steps. Another area is prayer. This is from one of my devotionals with A.W. Tozer. He says this: to pray successfully is the first lesson the preacher must learn if he is to preach fruitfully. Yet, prayer is the hardest thing he will ever be called upon to do. And, being human, it is the one act he will be tempted to do less frequently than any other. And yet we need to pray. We need to grow in prayer. And it's one thing to talk about it. We can do classes on prayer. And that's good. We've done classes on prayer. I've read books on prayer. I've read 20 books on prayer, probably. But you have to do it. You have to do it. God's Word. You know, the Bible doesn't read itself. Did you know that? It doesn't read itself. You can open it up, put your pillow on it, and sleep with, on top of it with your pillow, you know, at night. And you know, it doesn't help you one bit. Doesn't help you one bit. But it takes time. It takes discipline. Fellowship. I was thinking about this one. If you have ever spent any time at church, Oh my goodness. I feel sorry for you. At some point, you're going to get your feelings hurt. At some point, somebody at church is going to offend you. They're going to say something not very nice. They're going to be insensitive. They're going to say something that will embarrass you so much. All kinds of things we Christians do to each other. And yet the Bible says we need to grow in fellowship. The Bible says in Proverbs 27:17, as iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. Well, I mean, that requires rubbing against each other, iron sharpening iron. You know, sparks fly. The blade is sharpened, but it's not like a fun thing. It's not like you're oiling the blade. You know, you're rubbing it against metal against metal. And gang, sometimes that's part of what we need to grow. I will never learn the concept of patience unless I'm with you. Well, not you, because you're all wonder. I will never learn humility unless I spend time with people. And then somebody comes up and says, "Wow, you want to hear the most awesome thing that I did?" And you know what's the first thing I want to do? I want to say, "Well, wait till you hear what I did." You know, pastors are terrible at this. You go to a pastor's conference and it's like, "Well, I had 5,000 people come to our midweek service. It was kind of down for the week, you know, and you know." It's, you know, humility to learn that. I need to be with people. Grace. Learning to be gracious. You know, put that one on your prayer list for yourself. God, help me to be a gracious person. I'll warn you. God will put people in your life who are not gracious. See, we need fellowship. And I can't just ask God to teach me these things without me actually doing it. Forgiveness? Oh my gosh. How do I do that if I keep running away? Fellowship. It's a doing thing. Another thing I was thinking about was the concept of serving. I've said this before, and I will continue to say this because I haven't figured out a way to change the script. I believe this. I believe that a mature Christian is a servant. I believe that's what a mature Christian looks like. Why do I say that? Jesus said, "Whoever desires to become great among you shall be your servant." We believe that. We've kind of decided to write that into our church's DNA in a way, if you will. It took me a while to grasp that as a pastor. I didn't quite grasp that at the beginning. I wasn't sure. I was thinking maybe the mark of a mature church was having more people come to my Bible study. I was kind of really convinced of that one. I was really pretty sure of that. I decided that's wrong. I think the mark of a mature church, the mark of a mature Christian, is one who has learned to serve. But that's something you don't just pray for. You have to do it. You have to do it. And the mark of a good servant is being faithful. 1 Corinthians 4:2, Paul says, "It is required of servants that one be found faithful." That's what a good servant, a good steward is. He's somebody you can count on. Jesus, when he rewards us, in Matthew 25, the parable of the talents, his Lord said to him, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You were faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord." Faithfulness requires discipline. It requires that, I'm going to steal your joy, but it requires that you show up on Thursdays and you serve the food. God bless you, Brenda. That's an awesome thing. That's an awesome thing. Faithfulness. It's a part. It's the doing thing. I can't get around this. Just coming and listening to Bible studies isn't what grows me up. It's a part of it. Hopefully we will add some fuel to your tinderbox. But it's me getting out and doing the life that helps me grow. And that's what I love about this little teeny thing about Caleb. You know, he knows all about Hebron. He's the one that spied it out. And he asks for Hebron. Now, he takes it. By golly, I'm going to take it. And he drove the giant out. It wasn't just cheap words. He did it. Verse 15. Then he went up from there to the inhabitants of Debir. Formerly, the name of Debir was Kiriath Sefer. What does that mean? The city of Sefer. Very good. Very good. You're learning. And Caleb said, "He who attacks Kiriath Sefer and takes it, to him I will give Aksa, my daughter, as wife." Now, Debir is about 8 miles southwest of Hebron. It's also up in the hills. I thought it was kind of interesting as I was checking this thing out on Google Earth. This is Google Earth. And as you zoom over to where they think Debir is, that's one we're not quite sure of. But over on this hill over here. And this is also on the West Bank. This is a Palestinian territory. There is a Jewish settlement of about, I think they said 110 families and that have settled there, and they've named their town Othniel. Why is that important? Because you'll see in a minute. Because he's the guy that takes up he decides to do the challenge. So Caleb says, "Okay, I got a deal. Here we go." I don't know if they televise this as like one of those events, on TV or something. One of this reality TV. "Whoever takes this, I will give my daughter." Now, I was thinking about that. "Whoever, I will give X to my daughter." I wasn't sure if maybe he was having a hard time marrying the girl off, or if maybe actually she was quite the incentive. Maybe she was quite an incentive. Either way, somebody steps up and does it. Verse 17, "So Othniel, the son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb, took it, and he gave him Aksa, his daughter, as wife." Othniel, his name means Lion of God. I like that one. I think we should name a few more boys Othniel. Now, I don't know. I couldn't get my wife to agree to Hezekiah. I wanted to name some of my boys Hezekiah. She wouldn't go for that. I at least got Josiah into a middle name. She wouldn't agree to Hezekiah. But I'm thinking Othniel. Now that's a good name. Lion of God. Isn't that a great name? He's Caleb's nephew. So that means he and Aksa were kissing cousins. Okay, verse 18. "Now it was so, when she came to him, that she persuaded him to ask her father for a field. So she dismounted from her donkey, and Caleb said to her, 'What do you wish?' And she answered, 'Give me a blessing. Since you have given me land in the south, give me also springs of water.' So he gave her the upper springs and the lower springs." So he's just handing out all kinds of wedding presents. Now, back in verse 16, he says, "He who attacks Kiriath Sefer and takes it, that's the one that's going to get to marry Aksa." And just a little picture here before we go too far. There's a picture here of training the next generation. I don't think, if I understand correctly, that it would have been a big deal for Caleb to have taken it himself. He doesn't seem ready to kick the bucket yet. In fact, I think it was in chapter 14, he said, "I'm as strong today as I was when I was 40. I mean, oh my gosh, I can do this stuff." And he does. He takes Hebron. He knocks out the giants. But here, he leaves room for the next generation to step up. Even gives them an incentive. "I'll give you my wife." And maybe, whether she was pretty or not, you know what? You're going to be married to Caleb. I mean, Caleb's going to be your father-in-law. I mean, that's how cool is that? I mean, that's an awesome thing. He's training up the next generation. I found a great video of some children who have been trained. I could tell. These kids have been trained by Stephen. You'll have to watch the sound on this. Some kids who've been trained in the importance of good communication, facing their problems. Maybe you've seen this. Turn the sound up. Rebuking his brother about not having a sock on his foot or something. I wonder which one of the parents talks like that. Or maybe both of them. Just cracked me up. Sorry, that just cracked me up. It had nothing to do with the lesson, but I just had to make you go, huh? What's he doing here? Okay, sorry. Let's go back to our study. Othniel will play a role in the nation during the book of Judges. This isn't the last we've seen of Othniel. In Judges chapter 3, the nation will be oppressed by the king of Mesopotamia. And they cry out to God, saying, God, help us. Send us a deliverer. And Othniel steps up. And he boots out the king of Mesopotamia. And he judges, he rules the nation for a period of time. How could he do that? I think partly because he's been trained. He's been trained to take leadership and to move on. It's just a cool thing we're seeing here that's being planted. Caleb's behind it. He gives the incentive. He encourages the next generation. Chapter 15, verse 20. Now, we get a list from 20 through verse 63, a list of cities of Judah. You see the list there? You see? Are you looking forward to going through this list? I hope so, because we're going to go through this. Now, let me tell you, some cities are strange. There are some things you have to keep in mind with this. Some cities belong to more than one tribe. There are several cities that I can think of that belong to more than one tribe. So that will confuse you. You will also find that there are some cities that have the same name, but they're different cities. For example, if I say to you, I'm going to take my wife to Paris for the weekend, you might wonder, well, is he taking her to Paris, France? Some of you from Texas might be thinking I'm taking her to Texas. Some of you might think I'm taking her water skiing out at Lake Paris, you know. And so, cities that sound the same, but those are three very different cities, right? Right? With me? Same in Bible times. You're going to see some names, you're going to be tempted to go, oh yeah, I know that city. No, you don't. So you're going to have to sort through some of the stuff. Now, the other thing I want to say about this, these are real places. Now, maybe that's obvious to you. But that's what I love about the Bible. These are real places. And not to knock our Mormon friends, but to be honest, the Book of Mormon has a supposed history of things that took place in America around 600 BC. From 600 BC up to the time of Jesus. And they claim, they talk about battles and kings and all kinds of things. Places that are not real places. Places that cannot be located on a map. Peoples, events that we have no other evidence of other than Mr. Smith's book. In contrast, we know where a few of these places are. Not all of them. We know where quite a few of these places are. Some of these next couple chapters may sound boring to you, but I have learned that some of these chapters like over the next couple chapters in Joshua, as well as even like the other day, my wife was starting in her quiet time. She's on a different reading thing from me. She's in First Chronicles. I don't know if you've ever read those first 9 chapters of Chronicles. That's like one genealogy after another. It's great bedtime reading stuff. Put you to sleep in a minute. You know, it's really good stuff. But even with those, once you understand what they're about, you realize that these are some of the threads that hold the Bible together. So, put your thinking caps on. We're not going to read through everything. I'm going to skip a few verses here and there. But we're going to do what we did last time. Remember we did last time where I asked you to raise your hand every time you think that you recognize the name of a city? Okay, so let's just practice. Fullerton. Very good, Frank. You're supposed to raise your hand on Fullerton. Anaheim. Brea. Okay, so we're with it. Okay, here we go. So, where am I? Starting in verse 20. So, this was the inheritance of the tribe of the children of Judah according to their families. And you know what? Whether you're right or wrong, raise your hand if you think you recognize the name. The cities at the limits of the tribes of the children of Israel toward the border of Edom in the south were Kabzeel, Eder, Jagur, Kinna, Dimona, Adada, Kadesh, Hazor. Oh, well, somebody raised their hand on Kadesh. Here we go. Hazor and Ithma. Now, Hazor, actually, we have read about, but it's not the same Hazor. The Hazor we've read about is a different Hazor. It's up in the north. This one's in the south. Kadesh, we're thinking Kadesh Barnea. It's not it. Ziph, Telem, Bealot, Hazor. There again, another one. It's not the same one. That's good. Good. Dan, you're with me. All right. Good job, buddy. Hadata, Kariot, Hezron, which is Hazor. It's another one. Look at that. 3 cities. We still haven't got the one that was actually the Hazor that they beat a couple chapters ago, which is another tribe. Amam, Shema, Molada, Hazar Gada, Heshmon, Bet Pelet, Hazar Shual, Beersheba. Come on, we should see some more hands. More than that hands. There we go. Beersheba and Bizjata. Jata. Beersheba, that's the oasis of the southern desert where Abraham and Isaac dug their wells in Beersheba. And they each named it Beersheba for different reasons. It's fascinating stuff. Genesis 21 and Genesis 26, verse 29. Ba'ala, Ijim, Ezim, Eltolad, Chesil, Horma, Ziklag, good job, girl. Ziklag, Madmana, and Sansana. Now, Ziklag, I'll stop and talk about. That's the Philistine city that David and his men settled in when he was fleeing from Saul. And he settled in with the Philistines. He settled in Ziklag. They gave him Ziklag, and that was his headquarters. He would go out raiding and stuff. And one time he was out raiding, and they came and the Amalekites came and took Ziklag. That's the city. By the way, David is from what tribe? David is from what tribe? Judah. David's from the tribe of Judah. What tribe are we looking at the cities of? Judah. You're going to see cities here throughout this chapter that most of the ones I stop at are going to be cities about David because this is his home. Verse 32, Lebaot, Shilhim, Ain, Rimmon, all the cities are 29 with their villages. In the lowland, Eshtaol, Zora, Ashna, no hands. Eshtaol and Zora, those are cities where Samson hung out. I've got a good picture of Samson. There we go. Samson hung out in these cities. And when you follow Samson, remember there's a place with Samson where he was arrested, not by the Philistines, but by men of the tribe of, yes? Men of the tribe of Judah. Why? Because he was causing the Philistines such trouble while he was in their area. And so the Philistines went to the leaders of Judah and said, take care of this guy. Deliver him to us. And so this is all that territory. Kind of puts pieces together if you follow. Verse 34, Zanoa, Engamim, Tapua, Enam, Jarmut, Adullam, Soko, Azeka, Adullam. Adullam is one I want to point out. That's where David and his family hid in a cave. The cave of Adullam, when he was running from Saul, 1 Samuel 22. It mentions here also Soko and Azeka. That could ring a bell because that's where the Philistines were camping when David met Goliath. They were at this area. And again, these are in the tribe of what?
Judah.
So the Philistines were attacking in the land of Judah when David steps out and rescues everybody. Skip down to verse 38. Dilion, Mizpah, and Joktiel. Joktiel? I didn't know that one. I should look at that one. That one, I mean, Mizpah rings a bell, but it's not the Mizpah that Jacob was at. That's a different one. So this is another, wasn't the Mizpah I thought. Verse 39, Lachish, Boss, there we go. I saw Hanan, Lachish, and Eglon. Lachish is actually a major city that you've never heard of. It's mentioned 22 times in the Old Testament. It was actually a major city in the area. You will see it pop up more and more when you're studying the life of Jeremiah, because it becomes one of the main key Babylonian conquests, the city of Lachish. Skip down to verse 42. It mentions Libna, Eter, and Ashan. Libna is another one of those famous cities you've never heard of. Libna is found in 17 verses in the Old Testament. Also in the same period of time as Lachish. Verse 43, Jiftah, Ashna, Nezib, Keilah, Akzib, Akzib. I'm not doing a very good job as a Bible teacher. And Keilah is another one of those cities. That was a city that David saved from the Philistines. He's running from Saul, and he gets word that the city of Keilah is under attack. And David is under, and he says to his men, I don't know where, and his men say, you're thinking of rescuing them? We've got enough trouble rescuing them from the Philistines. We've got enough trouble on our hands as it is. And David goes to God and says, what shall I do? And God says, go get them. Go get them. And so he goes off and rescues the people of Keilah. And they take him in. He's a hero. And then Saul hears about it. And they say to Saul, hey, you want us to deliver David to you? We'll put his head on a platter and turn him over. Bunch of traitors, these people of Keilah. He just rescued them and now they're gonna betray him. That's the city of Keilah. Verse 45, Ekron with its town. Good girl. Ekron to the sea, all that lay near Ashdod with their villages. Another hand goes up. Good. Gaza with its towns. Don't you ever follow the news? Come on, Gaza. Everybody raise your hand. Gaza. That's the Gaza Strip. There you go. As far as the brook of Egypt and the great south of this coastline. Ekron, Ashdod, and Gaza. These are three of the five main Philistine cities. This is where the Philistines lived, out on the plain, out towards the coast. They had the beach property, the Philistines. They had the beach property, and actually there's a reason for it, but I don't have time for that. So these were part of the main Philistine cities, and these were given to Judah. Skip down to verse 54. Humta, that's a good city. Name that's Humta. Okay. Kiriath Arba, which is Hebron. There you go. Somebody's paying attention. Yeah, we just talked about that one. Very good, 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 good. And Zior, nine cities with their villages. Verse 55, Maon, Carmel, like that makes good candy. No, that's where Clint Eastwood was mayor, up in Carmel. And Ziph and Jutta. Now, actually, there's three of them in there. Maon was where David's running from King Saul. He spends time in the wilderness of Maon. And he is near the city of Carmel, which is in that area. That's not the Carmel that's in the very north of Israel, where we up where the harbor is, where the mountain is, where Elijah. But this is a different Carmel. This is the one where he meets a gal named Abigail, who saves him from hurting that fool Nabal. And then Nabal dies of a stroke, And he ends up marrying the widow, the pretty gal Abigail from Carmel. And it mentions Ziph. That was another one of those cities that almost turned David over to Saul. Verse 56, Jezreel, Jokdeam, Zanoah, Cain, Gibeah, and Timnah, 10 cities with their villages. One more I want to mention here is Timnah. Timnah is where Samson fell in love with his first Philistine girl. This is before Delilah. Before Delilah, there was another. And he actually married this one. She was a girl from Timnah. Remember then oh, it's another story. That's Judges chapter 14. Skip down to verse 60. Kiriath Baal, which is Kiriath Jearim, or Yearim, and Rabbah, two cities with their villages. Kiriath Jearim means city of forests. This is one of the cities. This is actually an important city. The Ark of the Covenant will spend 20 years at Kiriath Jearim. And when David finally moves the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem, he's taking it from the city of Kiriath Jearim. There's a couple other things, but we'll skip past that. Verse 61, in the wilderness, Beth Araba, Medin Sekaka, Nibshim, the city of Salt, and En-Gedi, six cities with their villages. En-Gedi should have some hands going up. En-Gedi, that's one of my favorite places. It's located on the Dead Sea. It's like an oasis out in the desert. This is one of the places where David was hiding from Saul. This is where the waters of the Dead Sea will turn fresh when God heals it, when Jesus comes back again, is at En-Gedi. Verse 63, as for the Jebusites, inhabitants of Jerusalem, the children of Judah could not drive them out. But the Jebusites, they didn't have a big enough car to drive them out. But the Jebusites dwelt with the children of Judah at Jerusalem this day. Jerusalem. Now, it won't be until David becomes king, which is 400 years from this point. It won't be until David becomes king that the Jebusites are bumped out of the city. So with the Jebusites are the original Canaanite owners of the city. And Jerusalem is one of those cities that is also shared. This is going to fall under the jurisdiction of the Benjamites as well. Benjamin will have a claim to Jerusalem as well. And it says they could not drive them out. The Jebusites are not driven out of Jerusalem. Take note of that. Verse chapter 16. Am I really going to do two more chapters? I might. I got 10 more minutes. I can do this. Especially since I'm not going to read. I'm not going to read this. The lot fell to the children of Joseph from the Jordan by Jericho to the waters of Jericho on the east to the wilderness that goes up from Jericho through the mountains of Bethel. Now, mentions the children of Joseph. Joseph is one of the 12 sons of Jacob. And technically, there should be a tribe called the tribe of Joseph. And there is. From time to time, you will hear it called the tribe of Joseph. But they don't get one portion. Instead, because Joseph was given a double portion by his papa Jacob when he was blessing the sons. And because of that, the tribe of Joseph is always divided into two tribes, Manasseh and Ephraim, who were Joseph's two sons. And we're going to get the boundaries specifically first of the tribe of Ephraim. We're not going to read all that stuff. There's the tribe of Ephraim. It's kind of in the middle. Here's Judah. We were just looking at Judah. Ephraim's up a little bit more to the north. It's not quite as big of a territory. Verse 10. Look at verse 10. And they did not drive out the Canaanites who dwelt in Gezer, but the Canaanites dwell among the Ephraimites to this day and have become forced laborers. Now, it says they didn't drive out the Canaanites either. The Judah people didn't drive out the guys out of Jerusalem. These didn't drive out the people out of Gezer. I think it's because they're waiting for them to become old Gezers before they drove them out. Because I thought, okay. Chapter 17. Manasseh. Verse 1. There was also a lot for the tribe of Manasseh, or Manasseh. Some of the some folks would say, for he was the firstborn of Joseph, namely for Machir, the son of the firstborn of Manasseh, the father of Gilead, because he was a man of war. Therefore, he was given Gilead and Bashan. Now, Gilead and Bashan, Manasseh has already gotten one portion. The tribe of Manasseh itself is going to have their territory split in two. And part of them have already gotten their land before they crossed the Jordan. Because here's the Jordan River, here's the Sea of Galilee. So one part of Manasseh has already gotten their land, because that was the stuff they conquered from King Sihon and Og. Remember that? And so half of the tribe of Manasseh has already settled their territory. But then he lists all these other sons that hadn't settled. Skip down to verse 7. And the territory of Manasseh was from Asher to Michmethath, that lies east of Shechem, and the border went along south, and it gives us the border of the rest of Manasseh. See, the eastern Manasseh was up here, and the western Manasseh is over here just to the north of Ephraim. So this is all, you might say, this is all the tribe of Joseph. Here's the tribe of Manasseh. Verse 11, and in Issachar and in Asher, Manasseh had Bet-Shan with its towns, Ibleam, and the inhabitants of Dor and its towns, the inhabitants of Endor and its towns, the inhabitants of Taanach and its towns, and the inhabitants of Megiddo and its towns, three hilly regions. Now it mentions that inside other tribes, like Issachar and Asher, which are to the north and to the east a little bit, that they actually had some towns inside the other tribes. And so you find, I remember years ago when I talked through the book of Joshua, it got very confusing plotting it all out. Because the borders aren't all so neat and clean. And you can draw lines, but the lines aren't all that nifty, because Manasseh has some stuff that he colors outside of the lines every once in a while. And so towns like Bet-Shan, this is like one of our favorite spots in Israel. It's just such this huge, absolutely gorgeous archaeological site. One of the biggest archaeological sites in Israel is at Bet-Shan. Absolutely awesome place. He mentions the inhabitants of Endor, and you know these folk because you saw them in the movies. They're Ewoks. The Ewoks live in Endor. That's the forest moon of Endor. Hey. Actually, you do know this place because Saul, before he dies, goes to the witch at Endor, and she conjures up Samuel's ghost, remember? So you actually know this book. It mentions Megiddo as part of Manasseh. It's one of the royal cities of the Canaanites, guarding the Valley of Jezreel. We went there last time. We were at Megiddo. This is probably kind of where we think Armageddon is going to be hanging out, because Armageddon means the mountain of Megiddo. Interesting place. Fun place. There's also the big Israeli Air Force base sitting in the valley of right below. Verse 12. Let's skip down to verse 12. Yet the children of Manasseh could not drive out the inhabitants of those cities, but the Canaanites were determined to dwell in that land. And it happened when the children of Israel grew strong that they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not utterly drive them out. So here we go. Here's the same old thing. They didn't finish the job. They didn't drive out inhabitants. Even, they can't even claim, well, we're not strong enough. Because even when they were strong enough, they didn't drive them out. In fact, they decided they would be better off taxing them. Make a little money on the side instead of driving out these guys. Hey, we've got some tax revenue coming in. What do we want to drive? Wipe them out? That doesn't make good business sense. But it's a pattern, and God had already warned the nation about this in Numbers 33. God says, but if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall be that those whom you let remain shall be irritants in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and they shall harass you in the land where you dwell. It's kind of like the opposite of what we talked about at the beginning of the message, about discipline, about working the program. They decided, you know, we don't have to get that serious about it. And God warns them, you know what? It's going to cause you trouble. It's going to cause you trouble down the road. Let's get down to verse 14. Then the children of Joseph spoke to Joshua, saying, "Why have you given us only one lot and one share to inherit, since we are a great people, inasmuch as the Lord has blessed us?" Now, it actually doesn't sound right, does it? Because if I remember looking at the map, they've already got like three sections of land, not just one. But who's counting? Now, they come to Joshua with this request. The children of Joseph. Anybody want to hazard a guess of what tribe Joshua is from? He's an Ephraimite. He's of the tribe of Joseph. They're coming to their homeboy. He's their bud. They're asking for favors. That's what they're doing. And they say, "We've only got one lot, and we want more." Now, I know sometimes this is confusing, because to me, this is almost like, "Well, wait a minute, this is good. These people want to take the promised land. They want more. Good, give me more." Kind of sounds that way. But the more you look at it, you find that this is not about wanting more of what God has. This is pride and a little sense of entitlement. They don't want to take more. They want to be given more. That's what you're going to see, verse 15. So Joshua answered them, "If you are a great people, then go up to the forest country and clear a place for yourself there in the land of the Perizzites and the giants, since the mountains of Ephraim are too confined for you." "Well, if it's still so small, well, that's fine. There's a mountain over there. Why don't you go take that one? Go get it. There's some giants over there, but just go get it." Now, he says, "Go up into the forest country." This isn't exactly what they wanted to hear. They were hoping that he could give them a few hotels and swimming pools. And Joshua's saying, "If you want more, go ahead. Conquer more. But it means you're going to have to work, and it's going to mean you're going to have to fight a little bit." Verse 16, "But the children of Joseph said, 'The mountain country is not enough for us. And all the Canaanites who dwell in the land of the valley," that's where the Philistines were hanging out, "have chariots of iron, both those who are of Bethshan and its towns and those who are of the valley of Jezreel." Now, Bethshan is just south of the Sea of Galilee. It's in a real hot spot down in the Jordan Valley. And the valley of Jezreel is up to the north. So they respond to Joshua by complaining. They don't like his ideas. His ideas are too hard. "It's too hard. I can't do that. Give me something easier." Joshua spoke to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, saying, "You are a great people and have great power. You shall not only have one lot, but the mountain country shall be yours. Although it is wooded, you shall cut it down, and its farthest extent shall be yours. For you shall drive out the Canaanites, though they have chariots, though they have iron chariots and are strong." He's not going to make it easy. They're going to get more room. They can have more room, but they're going to have to do it the right way. They're going to have to take, they're going to have to conquer the land. It means they're going to have to swing some axes. That means they're going to have to play Paul Bunyan for a little bit. It means they're going to have to swing some more swords and go out to battle with the Canaanites and drive them out. Don't need to be afraid of doing hard work, Dan. Working the program. Doing what I need to do. Learning discipline. Being faithful. Sometimes the best things require diligence. Sometimes we get the idea that if God's going to take care of all my needs, all I need to do is kick back and watch Gilligan's Island and watch God stick a paycheck in my mailbox every week. I haven't seen that one come off yet. Really haven't. Haven't seen that happen yet. I need to do my part. Ministry works that way as well. Excellence in ministry requires that we be diligent in what we're doing. Proverbs 22:29 says, "Do you see a man who excels in his work he will stand before kings. He will not stand before unknown. That's what God wants for us, is to be faithful.